the human body and human physiology is actually geared more towards something called allostasis, which involves kind of stress modulation. But without getting into too many details, you know, these are dynamic systems, meaning brain systems that are designed to allow us to overcome challenges if need be, right? This is why I always push back on the idea that, you know, stress crashes your immune system. You know what crashes your immune system? Being very, very stressed, working a lot, caretaking for someone else, and then stopping. You always get sick when you stop.
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because actually stress activates the immune system. Makes sense that it would do that evolutionarily, right? And then when we rest, boom, our immune system kind of relaxes a little bit, and then we succumb to that you know, the bacteria or virus. So what does it mean? It means that we should probably learn to modulate. It's like driving a car. Anytime we feel that we're headed toward or in a peak state, we should probably kind of like lean back off that state just a tiny bit. Just a tiny bit, especially if that peak state is coming by way of pharmacology or some extreme circumstance. Just back off a little bit, maybe a lot, okay? Mm. So when we do that, we learn to master the transition states between these, what I'm referring to as forward center of mass, flat-footed, or back on my heels. It's a term I learned from a former Navy SEAL operator. He said, with anything in life, you can either be back on your heels, like really challenged, flat-footed, kind of like calm and forward, or forward center of mass, like full tilt. I think most people would do very well to learn to master the transition states between waking and going to sleep, right? Many people can't fall asleep. Many people just kind of like can't turn it off. You can learn how to do that by doing things like non-sleep deep rest, some long exhale breathing, simple self-directed zero-cost tools that help adjust your autonomic nervous system to be more what we call parasympathetic, more rest and digest, just long exhales. Might not work the first time, but over time these become very effective tools to self-direct the shift from forward center of mass to flat-footed to just kind of laying back on your heels, and there you go, you're off to sleep. When you wake up in the morning, some people are just depleted. Maybe you didn't sleep enough, but learning to get forward center of mass shouldn't require, you know, excess caffeine and stimulants and super loud music and, you know, a shocking text or email. Ideally, you can transition pretty quickly into being forward center of mass, but not full tilt forward center of mass. And why do I say this? I think for anyone who seeks to be successful in any domain, academics, business, creative endeavors, whatever, if you want to have a long arc life and a long arc career, you really strive to control these transition states. And when I say control, all it really takes is paying attention to them and paying attention to the fact that, yes, some people just have inherently more energy. They can do every single workout at max output, then shower, they're talking in the gym, then they're off to that. Some people are like that. Some people, like myself, if I give 100% to something in the morning, by the afternoon, I'm a little bit depleted. So I require a 10 or 20 minute non-sleep deep rest or a nap or just some quiet long exhale breathing, maybe a little bit of caffeine, which I'm drinking now. I mean, there's nothing wrong with healthy stimulants, provided they're consumed in moderation. Maybe an energy drink, those can be great too for some people. And then, you know, really going like full tilt, focusing one's attention. And then afterwards, taking a few moments, just moments to downshift. I think we hear so much about the power of meditation or non-sleep deep rest or ice baths. What do cold plunges and cold showers do? They stimulate the release of what? The catecholamines, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, long duration release. That's why it's useful, in my opinion. For all the debate about deliberate cold exposure, does it increase metabolism? Does it not? The answer seems to be probably not much. But it's absolutely clear that it causes a huge increase in adrenaline, dopamine, and norepinephrine that are very long lasting. And that makes you feel great, especially when you get out of the cold. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the value of it. It also saves you on your heating bill. Like, you don't have to have a cold plunge. You take a cold shower. Nobody likes it. But the point is, you get out and you feel different. It's a state shift. So that's great, but you don't want to do it to excess, because then, you know, for instance, people always say, how long should I go in the cold plunge or cold shower? And I say, do it the minimum amount so that you get the effect that you're seeking, which is to be more alert and motivated. I have a friend, he did 30 minutes, for some reason naked. He said, I did 30 minutes naked in the cold plunge, and then I got sick and I'm feeling really low. And I'm like, because you did 30 minutes. I mean, I don't know about the naked part, what that had to do with it. But he had to throw that in there. He's kind of an extreme guy. And I said, how about 1 minute? How about 30 seconds? How about don't even pay attention to the time? Just get in and stay in as long as until you want to get out, and then push through that barrier and then get out. That might be a minute, might be 3 minutes. You know, protect yourself, be safe, but Just learn to overcome some challenge and then get out. You know, we have this fixation that more is better, and more is not better. You want the minimal effective dose, maybe a little bit more because we don't know where minimal is. People say, how many sets in the gym? Is it, you know, now it's like all about the volume hypertrophy, or like I've always fairly low recovery quotient. So for me, I like to do a couple warm-ups, a few hard sets, two or three hard sets, another exercise, two or three hard sets. That's it for that muscle group. Move on. People always say, well, volume is where it's at. Okay, great. But when I do 16 to 20 sets per week per muscle group, I'll tell you, I'm depleted. It doesn't work for me. And I sort of, I'll just be honest, I kind of chuckle at the exercise scientists who say, well, this is the way it is in this study. Great, that's not how it works for me. And even though I'm a scientist and I trust data, I also trust my own experience. And no one's gonna tell me that it's placebo because it's what's worked for me. So I think that you have to find what your capabilities are. And I do think if you look at dog breeds, of which I'm obsessed by, if you go to a dog show, which everyone should go to a dog show once, but don't watch the show. Go behind the show where you see all the different dog breeds. What you'll see is what I saw the first time I did that. You have dogs where they're wagging their tail all the time. They're super excited. They're alert. You can see their eyes, right? They're just bright-eyed. You can see the Great Danes. They're super still. And then my favorite breed, and the reason I own them, is the bulldog. The essence of economy of effort. They don't even lift their head off the ground. You walk over, you pet them, they'll like look up at you, they might wink. Very still animals. Very powerful, but very still animals. Now, I'm not wired like that, as you're probably getting the impression. I have a little bit more spontaneous movement, et cetera. So I need a lot of mental and physical stimulation in order to be happy, in order to feel fulfilled. So for me, there was a lot of work, and I still do a lot of work in order to learn how to downshift, take it down, become a good sleeper, become a good resetter. Reset myself during the middle of the day with things like non-sleep deep rest, which for me has been one of the most powerful tools, or long exhale breathing to just bring myself down. Other people, they tend to have a little bit less energy than life demands of them. So they need to do a bit more cold shower, a little bit more caffeine, but then those people probably need a little bit more rest. They're like the bulldogs of life. Mm-hmm. I think even though we're all the same species, just like dogs, there's a lot of variation there. So you have to know thyself, as the oracle said. Understanding a little bit about the catecholamines, understanding that certain things like exercise, deliberate cold exposure, stimulants like caffeine and prescription drugs like Adderall, et cetera, powerfully cause the release of these catecholamines, dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, leading to big increases in energy and focus, but then always, always, always there's a cost, a trough that follows. Accept that, relax through it, then return to baseline and then go forward. Or avoid those things altogether. I'm not telling people what to do. Obviously, the prescription drug thing in particular can be, you know, problematic for some people, even addictive. And certainly, I'm not a fan of drugs of abuse, like cocaine, amphetamine, absolutely, categorically. Never done them, never will. And then other people who tend to veer toward, you know, being hyperactivated. A lot of spontaneous movement. These people tend to be a little bit thinner, a little bit leaner, or just have a ton of natural energy. These people should really learn to incorporate more kind of what I would call calming and relaxing practices. Maybe a bit more sauna than cold plunge. Maybe don't crank the sauna to 220. You know, I find myself doing that. I'm like, just relax, like enjoy the sauna. And so I think the key to a good life and a productive life is, again, to learn to master the transition states, understand some of the biology, and to really know yourself, not just your natural tendency, more bulldog-like versus, you know, pit bulls always have their tail going, a lot of spontaneous movement. There are other breeds as well. But also know that on any given day, you may be more or less rested. You might be more or less depleted from life experience, and kind of recognize where you're at and figure out what's optimal for that day. In fact, I forget who the guy is. He's on Instagram, and there are a lot of self-help accounts out. Then there are a lot of self-help accounts out there. But one of the best things that I've heard recently, and I try and incorporate it into my life. In fact, it's in my notebook, is when I wake up in the morning, I sort of take stock of where I am in terms of how rested I am. I certainly take stock of what I need to do that day. And then I ask, what's something that I can do to make my life that day and the life of others better? Sometimes that means rest a little bit more. Sometimes that means push a little bit more. Sometimes that means call a relative that you haven't spoken to. But thinking about how to make things better on the timescale of a day, for oneself and for others, I think is what's manageable and it's what's realistic. And it takes this whole concept of protocols and biohacking and prescription drugs and supplements and workouts, and it brings a real world perspective to it. So I think we're living in the time of kind of almost avatars of these different things. Like I think about David Goggins, who I know well from the perspective of coworker, right? I consider him a friend, but we've never hung out outside of the work context. But I first met David back in 2016. And I'll tell you, he's always that way. At least when I've interacted with him, he's always been, you know, forward center of mass. It was late in the day on a work. This was a thing in Silicon Valley. It was down in San Jose, Santa Clara, San Jose area. In, I believe it was 2016. And we had been working all day in this part of this consult for this company. And in the afternoon, you know, there was like, do we take a break? Or do we push? He's like, no, we push. We're going to do this. And I thought, whoa, like this guy's intense. And he was changing because he was going to run to the airport, but not run to the airport in an Uber or drive to the airport. He meant run to the airport. And he did. So, you know, he's forward center of mass. He clearly has the energy, or he's found the energy. In the end, I think any creative endeavor is really about, and here I don't want to sound mysterious or woo, it's about the energy that we bring. It's about taking our life history and bringing it to that thing in whatever form. We don't even need to tell people our life history. Taking our unique wiring and bringing it to that thing. And we can, again, look at things through the lens of biology and say, well, what are we talking about when we're talking about energy? What is this energy thing that people are talking about? And I think it largely boils down to these catecholamines, the dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine cocktail that is setting the brain into a mode of attention, of motivation. We now know dopamine is more about motivation to seek rewards as opposed to feeling of pleasure or reward. There's a lot to be said about that. And keep in mind that these three neurochemicals, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, have been the neurochemical cocktail by which humans and other mammals have set and pursued goals for hundreds of thousands of years. So we don't have like a unique system, a unique neurochemical system for seeking out of mates versus food versus creating shelter versus creating technology and whole societies. And it's not just these three neurochemicals. Certainly there are other things involved, acetylcholine and, you know, a bunch of other things, neuroplasticity for that matter. But it's clearly the case that the currency that the brain has set around getting us into forward center of mass, as I say, to like envision something, explore. Nope, not down there, this way. Ah, there's a scent here. And trade out an actual scent for, you know, oh, there's something interesting here. There's someone interesting here. And like exploring that, no, that's a dead path to cul-de-sac, turn around, go, oh, here. And then connecting these nodes of progress. What's progress? Ah, there's kind of another surge of these catecholamines, which sets us in forward center of mass. You know, I don't want to oversimplify the biology, but when we talk about energy, for instance, taking time to rest at night, sleep, taking time to maybe meditate a few minutes or do this practice that I'm a huge fan of, non-sleep deep rest, which is kind of a body scan, deep relaxation, long exhales. It's a practice very similar to an ancient practice called yoga nidra, which has been practiced for thousands of years. It's a kind of pseudo sleep. And we know from a really nice study that NSDR, non-sleep deep rest, aka yoga nidra, can increase the baseline levels of dopamine in a brain area called the basal ganglia, which is for action generation and also withholding action, by about 60% from baseline. Just a short period of doing this practice can re-up dopamine levels to a considerable extent. It's a remarkable study, and there are others like it. So what does that mean? Well, it means that in rest, we build up this capacity to be forward center of mass when we emerge from rest. That's why I think we have to sleep every 24 hours. This is why practices where we deliberately calm ourselves and still ourselves allow us to be more forward center of mass mentally and physically afterwards. It's kind of a duh when we hear it. We kind of go, oh, duh, of course, rest, action. But there's a lot more to it. If you start exploring the layers, you start realizing that excitement for things versus burnout. What's burnout? It's just trying to be forward center of mass for too long. It's you know, misuse of our dopamine circuitry. It's, you know, ignoring the fact that these catecholamines and dopamine in particular, they are not infinite in their availability, right? There's a reservoir of them that can be depleted, but it can be replenished as well. And one of the best analogies for this was actually explained to me by a guy named Dr. Kyle Gillette. He does some online work as a public-facing physician, endocrinology in particular. And he said, with dopamine, it's kind of like a wave pool. You have this reservoir that can allow you to pursue things or scroll the internet or build businesses, whatever it is. If you are really forward center of mass, very intensely, you start generating these waves. And if you get big waves of dopamine and they crash out of the pool, you start depleting the reservoir. So when I think about drugs of abuse like cocaine, which leads to huge surges in dopamine, or amphetamines, huge surges in dopamine. What do we know about huge surges in dopamine? Well, after those huge surges, you drop below your initial baseline to a state in which the same thing doesn't feel as good anymore. You need so much more energy to get the same output.
That's what this is, right?
That's what this is. So
I'll put this on the screen for anyone.
Yeah, so my colleague at Stanford, Dr. Anna Lemke, who runs our dual diagnosis addiction clinic and wrote the wonderful book, Dopamine Nation, described this best. You know, it's sort of like a seesaw, but whereby you get a big peak in dopamine, mm-hmm. let's say from a drug of abuse like cocaine. People on cocaine, it's all about ideas and what's next. They're not like, hey, let's just kick back. It's all about in fact, they have a million ideas per second. Most of them are terrible ideas, but they're very forward center of mass, motivated. And then when the drug wears off, they feel very low and very depressed. The dopamine is actually depleted below baseline. People that work excessively, right? We all have different abilities to work out, but people that work excessively and abuse stimulants in order to do that achieve these peaks.
Is that like, so what would be an everyday example of that, working excessively? Do you mean like a pre-workout or something? What do you mean?
Yeah, I'm not anti-pre-workout. Listen, I love to be well-rested, hydrated, have a nice pre-workout drink, maybe even a little shot of espresso, listen to some music, and have an incredible leg day workout. It's an amazing feeling, right? But if you do that every single time, you start stacking all these catecholamine release-inducing drugs, okay? So you're getting adrenaline, you're getting epinephrine, which is adrenaline, excuse me. You're getting adrenaline, you're getting noradrenaline, also called norepinephrine. You're getting dopamine release. You're highly motivated. You're in that state that everyone is seeking, and you try and do that 7 days a week, you're not going to do it. And then you wonder why in the afternoon you're just completely cooked and you can't do any cognitive work. Well, your dopamine and other things have crashed below baseline. So I think it's important to understand that being, as I'm calling it, forward center of mass, like really kind of motivated and pursuing goals is great. But most of the time we're probably best off just coming off the gas pedal just a little bit to maintain that ability to continue to be forward center of mass. The same thing is true for stress. We hear stress is bad. Well, stress is bad, but it also sharpens your ability to learn. It creates energy. It actually boosts your immune system in the short term. I say, tolerate as much stress as you can, provided you still behave like a kind person, right? Don't say or do things that are unkind. And make sure that you still get great sleep at night. Most people, stress, run around, and then they can't sleep at night. And then the next day they're depleted. But a little bit of stress is healthy. Life is stress, things are stressful. But again, you're going to be in your best state of mind if you're calm and alert. Alert and calm is the magic recipe, and the ability to sleep at night. If you want to take a bunch of pre-workout and you want to listen to some loud music and have a great crush it workout, great. But you should probably also be able to train without all of that. If you're somebody who loves new goals and you know, you're very excited about travel and this and that, great. But do you have to layer in 50 things and then you're sitting around at home and you're wondering why you're so bored when you're back home and why life is so depressing and you need more travel, more stimulation? In every domain of life, we see whether or not it's food or exercise or stimulants or sex or media. If you push things to the max, you're going to feel depleted and understimulated afterwards. And this trough below baseline, as Anna Lemke taught us with Dopamine Nation, that trough is a state that can last a long time. And it's how long? It's proportional to how high that peak in dopamine was. Not how long, but how high that peak in dopamine was. And when you're in that trough, that dopamine depleted state, Typically what people do is they try and go out or access things that are going to reactivate the dopamine circuitry, and all it does is drive them further and further and longer into that trough. What's needed is a period of waiting, of non-indulgence in any of these excesses that allows them to return to baseline. We know this from drugs of abuse. It takes more and more drug to try and get what turns out to be less and less of a high. Most all addiction, most all compulsive behavior can be cured, essentially, through a period of abstinence lasting somewhere between 30 and 60 days, which to somebody who's highly motivated to seek that thing or do that thing sounds like an absolute horror. But that is highly effective. So for some people, it's work and stimulants. You know, a number of people taking Adderall and work. I hear from these people all the time. Typically, they are from the tech and finance world. And they're like, why am I burnt out? Well, you've been blasting these catecholamine-regulated circuits for years. You need to just accept you're going to feel a little low for a week. Then you're going to feel a little less low. Then you're going to come back to baseline. And then, and only then, can you really get back into like full forward center of mass. But at that point, you can introduce, you know, I do think there is a clinical use case for certain ADHD meds, which are amphetamine. There are certain people that need those meds. Other people have driven themselves into this dopamine trough, and so they're seeking out anything and everything to get them out of that trough, when really what they need to do is stay away from all that stuff and just wait. Just wait.
Go on holiday or something.
Go on holiday. Try and find reward in smaller things. You know, this is why dogs are wonderful, in simpler things. And if that sounds heavy and dull to you, chances are you're a bit in the dopamine loop. I've been in these loops before. They're hard to exit, but once you exit them, you look back on them and you go, what was I thinking? Well, you were in a different state. You're kind of a different animal when you're in pursuit. If you want to think about tools of any kind to modify your biology or physiology in any way, whether or not it's for cognitive function, or you want to get better at exercising, or you want to build muscle, or you want to improve your hormones, you need to think and understand tools in the context of modulation and mediation. What do I mean by that? Well, it's quite simple, really. Mediation is how specific types of chemicals and cells and circuits and organs control very specific things in your brain and body. Whereas modulation is the ability of chemicals and cells and circuits to adjust how different things change, how different things work in your brain and body, but to do it more broadly. What do I mean by this? Let me give an example. For instance, I'm going to tell you now that one of the most important things to build and maintain your focus and concentration is to optimize your sleeping behavior. That is to get enough quality sleep, I would say 80% of the nights of your life. Not everyone can get optimal sleep 100% of the nights of their life. Nobody, truly nobody, achieves that. However, sleep has been shown to relate to cognitive performance, physical performance, hormone output, and so many other things, including immune system function. What we can reliably say is that sleep modulates just about every process in your brain and body. So you have to get great sleep. There is simply no tool that's going to allow you to overcome chronic sleep deprivation and allow you to remain focused. No pill, no device, no supplement, no protocol whatsoever. There are tools to overcome one night or maybe two nights of sleep deprivation, and we'll talk about those. But at a fundamental level, we need to do the things that modulate our focus and attention in powerful ways, and sleep really is that thing. So we've done two episodes, one called Master Your Sleep, and the other episode is Perfect Your Sleep. The Perfect Your Sleep is a little bit more like this episode, more focused on protocols. Master Your Sleep includes protocols and mechanism. Again, you can find those at HubermanLab.com. We also have a sleep toolkit, a distilled list of things to do in order to optimize your sleep. I highly recommend that you download that. You can go to HubermanLab.com, go to the Neural Network newsletter. It is listed there. If you want, you can sign up for the newsletter, but you don't have to. You can simply download the PDF of that toolkit for zero cost. Why do I say sleep modulates focus and attention? Well, I'll give an analogy. If right now someone pulled a fire alarm in this building, or if we had a fire in this building, my attention would drift. It would not be on recording this podcast. It would be on something else. But would I say that the fire alarm mediates attention? I mean, fire alarms are not really involved in attention. No, rather, they modulate my attention. The noise in the room modulates my attention. That's quite a bit different than a tool that I'll provide later, and I'll just give you a little hint of now. In fact, I'll give it to you now, which is that 40 hertz binaural beats have been shown in a number of peer-reviewed studies to increase focus and concentration. And if you'd like to access 40 hertz binaural beats in order to improve your focus and concentration, you can do that. You can actually get it at zero cost. You can go into the App Store, for instance, the Apple App Store. This is also available for Android phone. There's an app called Brainwave, and you can go there. You can dial in 40 hertz, and it'll play these binaural beats. It's been shown in multiple quality peer-reviewed studies that playing a pattern of sound waves to one ear, do-do-do-do-do, and the other ear, which is slightly offset in frequency, meaning not quite the same frequency, so more like do-do-do-do, that combination of frequencies played to the different ears actually get integrated within deep brain centers and can increase focus and concentration in part by increasing levels of the neurochemical dopamine and acetylcholine, which we talked about a little bit earlier in this arrow model of focus. So we'll provide a link to that app. I don't have any relationship to that app, I should mention, but it's an excellent one. It's one that I've used for many years. There are also additional functions within the app, such as for sleep and for other things, but the 40 hertz, 40HZ, is the way it reads out. 40 hertz stimulation has been shown to improve focus and concentration. Here is my recommendation in the way that I use it. I would not use 40 hertz binaural beats every time I'm doing a bout of work. What I tend to do is use it for about 5 minutes prior to that work and then turn it off and then do the work. And I'll talk about other tools to use during that work, whether or not it's reading or math or even just emailing or something where I require a bunch of focus for a while. However, there are times in which I'm in an area or I'm in a state of mind where I'm feeling very distractible, and then I'll keep the 40 hertz binaural beats on the entire time I'm doing that bout of cognitive work. I'll also sometimes use the 40 hertz binaural beats prior to a workout, in particular weight workouts, where I really want to be able to focus on and contract specific muscles. So it's a very useful tool, again, supported by quality peer-reviewed science, zero cost, available out there, not just in the Brainwave app, but in multiple apps. I think many of you will benefit from it. Some of you might not experience it immediately as a total dropping into a tunnel of focus in the same way that you might with, say, the sorts of neurochemicals that we'll talk about later, like alpha-GPC and some of these other things that change neurochemicals directly. But nonetheless, 40 hertz binaural beats are a very powerful tool. Again, zero cost, non-pharmacologic tool that tap into your own endogenous, meaning within you or exists within you physiology, in order to increase acetylcholine and some other neurochemicals, and they have been shown to work quite well. Okay, so assuming that you are sleeping well 80% of the nights of your life, or at least working on the various protocols and tools to sleep well and sufficiently long 80% of the nights of your life, and you are interested in additional tools that are sound-based in order to improve your ability to concentrate and focus, there are quality peer-reviewed studies supporting the idea that white noise or pink noise, and believe it or not, there is something called pink noise. It has to do with the specific frequencies of sound that are in the noise. Well, white noise and pink noise have been shown to not improve concentration per se, but to improve people's ability to transition into concentrated states. So I don't tend to use white noise and pink noise while I work, but I know a number of people that do. I know people that also use what's called brown noise. The folks I know from the engineering and computer science side get really into these details of white noise, pink noise, brown noise. You can find white noise, pink noise, or brown noise and listen to it through headphones or in the room. There is indeed some data to support the fact that white noise, and to some extent pink noise and brown noise, can support the release of particular neurochemicals, but more data showing that they can amplify the activity of neurons in the so-called prefrontal cortex, this front area, sort of the bumper behind your forehead, that is directly related to your ability to direct your own focus and remain focused on certain things. So you have the option of either using binaural beats before, but not during your work, that is 40 hertz binaural beats, or 40 hertz binaural beats throughout your attempt to focus. You also have the option of not using binaural beats, but using white noise, pink noise, or brown noise. Again, there are a lot of zero-cost apps. You can find also white noise, pink noise, and brown noise on YouTube. Again, these are tools that really have been shown over and over in humans to allow people to focus with more depth and to decrease the transition time into focus. This is a really key point. A lot of people are challenged with getting into a mode of focus. None of us, however, should be expected to just sit down and drop directly into a state of focus. I think that's completely an unfair request of ourselves. I mean, for instance, you wouldn't expect yourself to go out on the track or go out for a run and not warm up. You might jog for a few minutes or even walk before you would jog and then jog before you would run, right? I would hope you would do that. And if you're doing resistance training, I doubt that you go over and load up the bar or the machine with the maximum amount of weight that you can move and then just drop right into that. You always do a warm up. And I think it's very important to understand mental work, focus, and concentration as requiring that warm up. What is that warm up? Well, you know what that warm up is. That warm up is the ramping up or the increase of epinephrine, adrenaline, acetylcholine, and dopamine. Right. The way that neurochemicals work is we don't just get to flip switches in our brain because we decide to. That's a fantasy. That's sort of the limitless movie or movies and ideas that suddenly, you're going to flip a switch on your arm and all of a sudden you're going to be in a laser focus. That is just not the way that your nervous system works. There's a gradual dropping into any state, whether or not that state is sleep, right? You go from shallow sleep to deep sleep and then out eventually. Focus two, you go from shallow focus to increasingly deep focus. That is in our metaphor of the arrow, it's very broad. It's pointed at a lot of things. And over time, as we drop into focus, that arrow is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. In fact, probably better to think about it narrowing and then sometimes oscillating and getting wider again. We might hear something down the hallway, or more typically our phone will buzz, or we'll think, oh, I wonder what so-and-so is doing, or I hadn't contacted them about something. Your focus is dynamic. It is not what we call a step function. It's not like you go from unfocused to focused and then you drop into your maximal focus. By understanding that it's dynamic, by understanding that you are going to be continually going in and out of progressively but varying levels of focus, you will greatly release the pressure on yourself to feel focused all the time when you want to be. This is very key. People who are very good at focusing understand this and understand that they can't expect themselves to just immediately focus and then snap into or out of focus. Okay, so be patient with yourself and also understand that focus is an ability, that you can improve your ability to focus by engaging the neural circuits responsible for focus repeatedly over time through so-called neuroplasticity, the ability of your nervous system to change in response to experience. And that has a couple of different components, but put very simply, what we repeat gets etched into our nervous system and becomes easier over time. And the more emotionally important or vital something feels to us, the more likely it is to trigger neuroplasticity. We're going to talk a little bit more about how to increase neural circuits for focus later, but right now what you have in hand is the key importance of sleep. And I again will direct you to HubermanLab.com and the Neural Network newsletter to really work on optimizing your sleep. We've also got two auditory sound-based tools for improving focus. There's 40 hertz binaural beats used before or during bouts of focus and concentration. And if you don't like those, or even if you do, you might alternate them with or occasionally use white noise, pink noise, or brown noise, also readily available at zero cost. I also want to touch back on this idea of which foods can increase focus. In the episode on ADHD that I did, I touched on this quite a bit as it relates to elimination diets. There's a whole industry and a ton of interest for obvious reasons into what sorts of things kids and adults should and shouldn't eat in order to reduce symptoms of ADHD. I think that the sum total of those data point to the fact that reducing simple sugar intake and certainly highly processed foods, so ice cream, candy, chips, etc., those sorts of things really does seem to improve symptoms of ADHD in both children and adults. But once you move past that and you start to say, well, which foods can improve concentration and focus? Well, foods that, for instance, include a lot of tyrosine, which is a precursor to dopamine, and now you know why dopamine is important in this context, are certainly going to increase concentration and focus. So things like Parmesan cheese, certain meats, certain nuts, you can look up which foods contain high amounts of tyrosine. There are also some fruits and vegetables that include higher amounts of tyrosine. But to be quite direct, it doesn't matter whether or not you're ingesting foods that are rich in the precursor amino acids to dopamine, acetylcholine, etc., if you are consuming large amounts of those foods. That is, one can look and see, for instance, that a steak includes a lot of the precursors to acetylcholine. It has amino acid precursors to dopamine as well, and there are other foods that will do that as well. But if I were to ingest, say, 2 ribeye steaks, that's a lot of meat, and it will direct a lot of blood to my gut, and it will cause me to be sleepy, and that will create challenges in me being able to achieve states of focus and concentration. So the simple way to put this is, if you eat too much or you eat a very large volume of food, you are going to diminish your focus and concentration. Okay, the key is to eat enough that you're nourished for the certain activities, mental and physical, that you need to perform. But if you're eating large meals, you are going to diminish your concentration and focus, period. I know many people are curious as to whether or not caffeine can improve focus and concentration. And indeed, it can. There is an immense amount of data supporting the idea that caffeine, provided it's consumed in the appropriate dosages, can improve mental performance and physical performance. And it largely does that through improvements in focus and concentration. The dosage of caffeine, of course, is going to depend on how caffeine adapted you are, how much caffeine tolerance you have. And that is going to vary tremendously depending on whether or not you ingest that caffeine with or without food, as I mentioned earlier. But there is a kind of general range in which we can talk about caffeine as being useful for focus and concentration. And the range is basically from 100 milligrams to 400 milligrams. I want to caution everybody out there. If you're somebody who suffers from anxiety or panic attacks and you're not used to ingesting caffeine and you run out and ingest 400 milligrams of caffeine in the form of espresso or yerba mate or an energy drink or in pill form, that is going to be very uncomfortable for you. You're going to be sweating profusely. Your heart rate is going to increase. You're going to be quite panicked, in fact, or at least anxious. So be cautious with your use and adopting of caffeine if you're not already caffeine adapted. There are other ways to increase epinephrine in the brain and body besides caffeine or other stimulants. And in fact, that has been studied. There's an excellent study that was carried out not that long ago on how stress itself can increase our ability to focus and concentrate. That's right, how stress itself can increase focus and concentration. You know, most people think of stress as impairing our ability to focus, but that's actually not true. When we are stressed, it involves the deployment, the release of adrenaline, epinephrine, and that adrenaline both changes our visual field. In other words, it narrows our vision to a more tunnel-like focus. That is, it makes the arrow in our metaphor of the arrow more sharp, and it improves our concentration. This makes sense given what we know about stress. When we're stressed, we tend to be stressed about a specific thing. We start anticipating or wondering or thinking about what's gonna happen next, what led up to this, how is this gonna impact me, how do I feel right now? It really narrows the context of our thinking and our behavior. So one of my favorite studies that really illustrates how stress can improve concentration and performance is one that was published not that long ago, and I will provide a link to this in the show notes. It's a paper published in the journal Experimental Psychology in 2020. The title of the paper is, not surprisingly, Acute Stress Improves Concentration Performance. First author, DeGroote, DeGroote. And this study involved taking a number of subjects and stressing them out or not prior to a cognitive or concentration task. And there are a lot of data in this paper, but I'm just going to home in on one specific set of data. And I should mention as I go there that they measured things like cortisol, a stress hormone, they measured anxiety. It was a quite thorough study. And what they found was that concentration performance improved manyfold, I should say, from there was a greater than doubling of concentration and performance in the stress group. And stress in this context was provided using a standard way of inducing stress. What they basically do is they bring subjects into the laboratory and they have to either do something fairly mundane in the control group, or they have to do a simulated job interview, an arithmetic task, and they're being evaluated as they're doing this. So this isn't, you know, intense psychosocial stress. You know, they're not watching anything disturbing. They're not being traumatized in any kind of way. This is fairly low levels of stress that raise their levels of epinephrine, and we know this from this study, and other levels of cortisol, another stress hormone, modestly within their brain and blood. But that even modest increase in these stress hormones and their reported psychological levels of stress really enhance their focus and concentration. This may come as surprising because you like many people think, gosh, stress really diminishes cognitive performance, but that's absolutely wrong. Stress improves cognitive performance. Now, of course, there are other ways to increase stress levels and to do that in healthy ways to improve concentration and performance. And one of the best ways to do that, because it's so surefire and it's generally safe, provided you do it safely, is deliberate cold exposure. This is something I've talked about on the podcast before, but deliberate cold exposure can be achieved by getting into a cold shower for 1 to 5 minutes. If you're not used to it, you probably want to start with 1 minute, or you can get into an ice bath. And nowadays there are a number of different commercial sources of circulating cold water. Or if you have access to a body of cold water, like a lake or a pool or an ocean, we know that getting into cold water or under cold water greatly increases epinephrine levels and dopamine levels in the brain and blood. There's a beautiful study that was published in the European Journal of Physiology that showed that the increases in dopamine are massive, you know, a near doubling or more of dopamine levels that are very long lasting for hours. And epinephrine and indeed cortisol levels are also increased, and in ways that support not just immune system function, because they do that, but and mood, because it does that, but that can really improve concentration. The question I often get is, how long should I try to focus? Well, the research literature point to the key importance of so-called ultradian cycles. You've all probably heard of circadian cycles or circadian biology. Circa, the day, circadian, is about 24-hour cycle. Well, our brain and body operate within that day, or within each and every day, I should say, with 90-minute ultradian cycles. So my suggestion would be, anytime you're going to sit down and try and focus, you're going to try and do a focused bout of physical exercise or skill learning or musical learning, or maybe you're even just having a conversation, maybe you're a therapist or you're attending therapy or a class, how long should it be? And the ideal duration is about 90 minutes. Not exactly 90 minutes, but we can reliably say 90 minutes or less. Okay, it doesn't have to be the full 90 minutes, but trying to push yourself to be able to drop into 2 hours of focus or 3 hours of focus, while possible, is not really in line with what we know about the underlying biology. Everything from our sleep states, or the different stages of sleep, and our waking states is divided into these 90-minute cycles, or so-called ultradian cycles. So what I like to do is set a timer for 90 minutes. I acknowledge and accept the fact that under most conditions, unless I'm really pressed for a deadline and I'm optimally caffeinated, etc., the first 5 to 10 minutes of that 90 minutes are a transition time. It's like the warm-up for focus, but I do include it in that 90 minutes. And then I really try and drop into doing focused mental work or learning of some sort. Again, this could be physical as well, motor skill learning, or I think we're running or lifting weights, et cetera, and really try and drop into that across the full 90 minutes. Again, accepting the fact, okay, it's not just an idea, the fact that occasionally our focus will flicker. It will jump out of focus. And then a big part of being able to focus is to go back to focusing. The way I'd like you to conceptualize this perhaps is that arrowhead suddenly getting very, very broad, that you're focusing on many things, or that arrow shifts to a different location in the room. The key is to be able to shift it back and to narrow it once again. And that's an active process, so much so that it requires a lot of metabolic energy. Your brain is the chief consumer of metabolic energy. The calories that you consume is so-called basal metabolic rate. Most of that isn't related to movement or heartbeat or breathing. It's related to brain function. Your brain is a glutton with respect to caloric need. So understand that at the end of 90 minutes, or maybe even after 45 minutes, you might feel rather tired or even exhausted. And it's very important that after a bout of focus, that you take at least 10 minutes and ideally as long as 30 minutes and go through what I call deliberate defocus. You really want to focus on somewhat menial tasks or things that really don't require a ton of your concentration. This is starting to become a little bit of a movement out there in the kind of pop psychology and optimization world. This idea of not looking at your phone as you walk down the hall to the bathroom, certainly not looking at your phone in the bathroom. And I should mention, by the way, this is a particular annoyance of mine. Have you noticed that wait times for restrooms in public places has increased substantially in the last 10 years. The reason for that is not digestive, okay? It's not the gut microbiome. I mean, it might be the gut microbiome, but chances are it's because people are on their phones in the bathroom. So you're doing yourself and everybody else a favor by staying off your phone in the restroom, staying off your phone while walking down the hall. Try and give yourself some time to deliberately decompress, to let your mental states idle, to not be focused on any one thing. That period of idling is essential for your ability to focus, much in the same way that rest between sets of resistance training or rest between exercise is vital to being able to focus and perform during the actual sets or during the actual bouts of running or cycling or whatever your particular form of exercise might be. So deliberate decompression is key. And I know this is hard because we're all being drawn in by the incredible rich array of sensory information available on our phones and other devices. But I can't emphasize this enough. Our ability to focus is not just related to what happens during the entry and movement through those focus bouts, but after those focus bouts. We really need to deliberately decompress. And of course, the ultimate decompress, the time in which we are not directing our thinking and our action, is during sleep. And so it's no wonder, or I should say it holds together logically, that that deep, long-lasting duration of not controlling where our mind is at is in fact the ultimate form of restoration, even if we have very intense dreams. So take that period after each 90-minute or less focus bout, right? Remember, those focus bouts don't have to be full 90 minutes. Let's say you do 45 minutes of work. You're just done with it. Set it down and go do something for maybe 5, 10, maybe even 30 minutes that is functional for your day, right? Just not just walking around in circles or staring up at the sky, although if you can do that, do that. But most of us have other things to do, but do things that are rather automatic or reflexive for you, and try not to do any focused reading. Try not to bring your vision into a tight location, such as your phone, and try and deliberately decompress, because that will allow you to drop into intense bouts of focus again, repeatedly and repeatedly throughout the day. I'm often asked how many ultradian cycles one can perform throughout the day. That depends on how well you've slept, how well you are nourished, which we'll talk about in a moment, and how well trained up your focus capacity is. And here's the paradox. If you are very trained at focusing, if you're very good at dropping into focus, you're actually going to need more deliberate decompression and defocus. And I recommend only doing about 2, maybe 3 deep work sessions per day. So not one 90-minute session, then expecting yourself to do another one, another one, another one, but rather one deep work 90-minute session and maybe another in the afternoon. A lot of people get surprised by this and say, wait, how many people can afford to just work 3 hours a day? I'm not saying just work 3 hours a day. I'm really talking about the hard mental work. And again, somewhat paradoxically, the more you can concentrate, the more deeply you can concentrate, the fewer deep work concentration bouts you can actually perform each day. It makes sense, however, if you think about it in the context of, say, resistance training. If you are stronger and stronger in the gym, or you're an endurance athlete and you can run, you know, ultra marathons, 100 miles or so, you are essentially cutting a deeper cut into your recovery capacity than somebody who's not very skilled at those things or can't perform as much intense work. So the intensity of the work scales directly with how long you need to rest after that work. The idea of things ending is super hard. And as a consequence, I've stayed in relationships far too long. I mean, you know, I sometimes joke, but it's not funny. My breakup protocol sucks, and it really needs work, because everyone close to me who knows me really well and who I trust says, you stay in relationships way too long that were either fated to fail or that were clearly going to fail. At some point, you just kept slogging away. Now, sometimes I slogged away in the wrong ways, and they did too, but somehow I've really struggled to move on from things. And as a consequence, I've stayed in things far too long that never had a chance, that were really unhealthy. And in particular, I've taken on things that were just far too difficult from the beginning. And so that relationship was a beautiful relationship. I'm fortunate that I'm still friends with that person, although we have to keep a certain amount of distance, just at healthy boundaries. And, you know, I get emotional because, like, damn it, like, we fought so hard, like, so hard. And it was all out of love. But I think I know that it failed because we just didn't have the skills. The timing wasn't right. And I'm certainly not talking about this most recent relationship, you know, this year's hard stuff. This was some years back, but like, we fought so hard, and like, I would have done anything, and she would have done anything to make it work. And I'm just like, I'm not a quitter. I'm far from perfect, believe me, but I'm not a quitter. And as a consequence, I think after that, for a while, it just really changed the way that I interacted with things. I just didn't quite recover. And one could argue that the emotion that's coming up for me now means that I didn't recover. But I know I just refuse to call it time of death. I just refuse to call it time of death, even when it's long since dead. And that's a mistake, and it's something I'm really working on now, because it hurt me, it's not good for other people, and it dovetails with a bunch of other unhealthy ways of being. But what I know for sure is that it's not selfishness. It's not that I'm trying to avoid pain for myself. It's related to my failure to be able to just tolerate pain in other people and myself simultaneously. There's something about empathy gone wrong in those circumstances.
Does that link to your childhood? Parents, the parental separation and the...
Yeah, so people I pay a lot of money to tell me that it no doubt does. But what's weird is I never lament the separation of my parents. I don't sit back and go, oh, I wish they had stayed together. They're both wonderful people. They both have wonderful partners. Like, I've had a magnificent life. I've had a great life. Like, everything I've sought to do has happened. And there's still things I want. But I think that I was talking to Martha Beck about this recently. There's this feeling with a dog where I love the dog. And they love you back, particularly my dog, Costello, right? I loved him and he loves me back. And so it's like empathy, but then it's return. It's like a perfect circle. It's like the energy is like, the more I love, the more love I feel, the more love. And I think with people, it's not like that, right? You know, people are gonna disappoint us, et cetera, but they can also delight us. But I think that there's been this problem where my empathy goes too far. And I'm sure as I'm saying this, people are like, oh God, he's trying to mask this in empathy. No, I can wholeheartedly say didn't always lead to the best choices, and I own those choices, but meaning I'll take responsibility for my part. I won't take responsibility for other people's part, right? It's always a two-way street. But when we have a sense of empathy and that other person isn't right for us, and we continue to try and like feed the relationship, it's not about trying to avoid getting them upset, but somehow we get into these unhealthy dynamics, and then, you know, it can really bring out not the worst, but some really like unhealthy parts of people. You know, I think probably the hardest thing in life is romantic relationships. Some people might say it's work, but I think it's the hardest thing in life. And people say, well, when it's right, it's easy. I don't know. I think it depends on how complicated a person you are. You know, I think it depends on how complicated a person you are and the extent to which the other person is willing to do the work. I've really seen this. I've also had wonderful relationships whereby we're each willing to do the work on self-care and communication. You know, Paul Conte said this, not on my podcast, but I think he was telling Whitney Cummings on a podcast, you know, if you were to list out the 100 most important things in romantic relationship, you would just say self-care and communication 50 times. And I think that's absolutely true, because we need safety, we need acceptance. Yes, those are foundational, non-negotiables, necessary but not sufficient. But I think we need communication and self-care, and those are hard. And you know, I'm still learning, you know, trying to build those skills. I absolutely want a family, so this is super important to me. And I'm putting a ton of work and effort into it. So you know, I didn't realize we were gonna go into this territory, but I will say for people who are struggling with relationships, just know that, you know, you can have amazing friendships and still struggle with romantic relationships, or vice versa. Again, like friendships, and I have male friends and female friends, mostly male friends, but a few female friends that I'm very close with. Like, it's just been amazing. I have a great relationship with my sister. I think I have a very good relationship with my parents, with my uncles and aunts, like with my coworkers, my ability to pick business partners and coworkers, just, I only hit bullseyes. Like, I love my team and we get along great and little things get worked out quickly. And but I think everyone has one or two areas of life where it's a bit harder, and just try and learn the skills, and I'm working on it. Like,
what is the true meaning of your life? Why do you exist?
Goodness, that's a tough one. Meaning, it's hard to distill that down. But I'll pause for a second in an effort to keep it uncharacteristically brief. You know, as I mentioned earlier, all I have is my experience, the knowledge that I gain from that experience, and my words. And for me, the purpose of my life is to make the best possible choices that I'm capable of making at the time in terms of what to seek out, what to learn, and what to share. And I think the real meaning of my life is to try and provide useful information and tools so that people can be a better version of themselves, for themselves and other people. And I know it sounds lofty and kind of empty and cliche on the one hand, but I mean it. I wake up in the morning and I think, what can I learn? What am I excited to learn? And then when I come across gems, I just compulsively have to tell people about it, but not because I need to do it for me. It's because I feel like people need to know about this. This can really help. Mm-hmm. This can really help. This can potentially really, 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 really help. Mm. So I think that's the meaning of life for me.
Right now.
Right now. And at some point it may be just to provide care for little Hubermans. at some point it may be something entirely different. I've learned to not anticipate what the next steps will be for me. More than 5 years out, you know, I've seen some ridiculous speculation that I'm going to go into politics, probably related to the fact that I kind of alluded to it once or twice. I'm not going into politics. I'll tell you right now, there's no chance I'm going into politics. It runs countercurrent to my nature. And even if politics changed entirely, it's not for me. What is for me is learning and adventure and sharing what I learn. And that's the only way I know how to be.